You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Tuning in to the Best Practices Show, where we take a look at the best business practices from the best practices all over. And boy, do I have a treat for you today. So we have just an incredible show today, and you are not going to want to miss this. But I want to welcome you to the number one podcast, and where we're just focused on giving you the best information, helping you create a better practice and a better life. And if you're joining us for the first time, I want to do two things. Number one, I just want to welcome you to an incredible community of people that are just committed and never stop learning. And then the second thing I want to do is just congratulate you just for showing up and contributing. So many of you did it for the COVID conference. And we're going to bring back one of our heroes today who helped us get it off the ground and just kept us sane that whole time. Also, I want to encourage you to subscribe to podcasts wherever you listen. Over 100,000 downloads audio-wise. Over 35,000 of you opted in for the COVID conference. And we're actually going to be doing a reunion. I'm going to tell you about that in a little bit next Friday. But just stay tuned so you can keep getting great information. Every single week, we're going to be bringing you brand new information from some of the best experts, again, because we want you to get the very most out of this. Now, when we were talking about getting everybody back, I was texting you and I'm like, John, we got to get you back. Like, tell us what's going on. And today, you and I were talking before we went live. We were just talking about, okay, where do we need to go today about the actual virus and what we learn? And I want to start slow, because if somebody's jumping on for the first time and they've never heard you, let's start with who you are, John Molinari, and then we'll talk about where we're at with the COVID virus. What do you think?
Okay. Well, my name is John Molinari. I'm a microbiologist. I'm Professor Emeritus at University of Detroit Mercy School of Dentistry. I taught in dental schools at Pittsburgh and mostly in Detroit for over 50 years. I worked as the Director of Infection Control, the Dental Advisor, for about 6 or 7 years, where we did infection control research on new products and technologies, which was very exciting. I've always been a lab rat, so that was good. So I guess I've been in microbiology, immunology, infectious diseases now for over 55 some odd years. So it's an area that I've worked in. I've had a lot of experience with my medical colleagues. And so with COVID, which has presented the latest far-reaching challenge, we've had to draw on a lot of science expertise and development to help us get out of this. And so thank you for asking me to come on. I have a number of good references and people that I look to out there who are doing incredible work to make sure that the science helps us get through all this.
Yeah. Now, so if you're a dentist and you went through dental school, you probably saw a lot of things, or you're a hygienist, you're classically trained. This is one of the guys behind If Saliva Was Red, you know. So it's really powerful. You've been a great voice for dentistry for so many years, and I consider you one of the top experts in infection control. So, you know, I'll just tell you a little bit. You know, when we were panicking when March 18th, 19th, and 20th happened, we were assembling people we would talk to, and your name came up over and over. And I'm like, let's get him on. And you were so awesome because we didn't know what to think, you know. And what I want to do today is I want to cover, like, where are we and what have we learned now? And there's a lot of questions that I get I can't answer. So I figure we just start with this. And one of the things you said before we went live, you're like, science matters. Like, in a world where we're kind of turned upside down, can you just talk about that phrase, science matters, and what that means to you?
Well, we know so much about respiratory viruses, yet there's so much that we are still learning, obviously, with this type of coronavirus and some of the other viruses. But we have so much information that we can use as background to build on. And what you need is an organized approach. You need a systemic approach. You need laboratories. You need clinical observations and studies on patients. All of these things have to come together. People just don't come to a conclusion because this is what they think is right. It has to be based on something. And I'm not going to get on a pedestal and all that, but I mean, science is where the facts matter. It's not just an opinion, and you have to base it on things. There are some incredible people out there. I'll just mention three of them: Dr. Fauci, Dr. Osterholm, Dr. Schaffner. These are long-standing clinical mycologists, immunologists who have done it for many decades in hospitals and clinical medicine as infectious disease specialists. And they and their colleagues are people that provide excellent information. So I get a lot of my information from reading about the science. The opinions come from what you actually know, but it has to be based on the facts.
For sure, for sure. Now, obviously, you know, people are going to want to know about the vaccine. We got the flu season, but let's start with what we know. So, you know, we've learned a lot, you know, and tell us what you have learned about this virus since mid-March, and where are we today with all of it?
Okay. Well, this is a complicated virus. It's a coronavirus, like the one that caused, you know, it's the same genus that caused SARS back in 2002, 2003, and Middle East Respiratory Syndrome in 12, you know, that came out of Saudi Arabia. But this is far more infectious than both of those. The death rates were higher in those, but they were many, many times less infectious in this. And so this type of coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, is far, far more infectious. And as we learn literally every week, ramifications of infections have become much more complex than what we first saw in February, March, or the early days, because now we have so many more people that have recovered. Tragically, we've had so many more people that have died, but we learned from also the recovery. Well, what I'm getting at is, you remember early on, Kirk, people were talking about after they recovered from coronavirus, which most people do, fortunately. We had reports of people losing sense of taste, sense of smell. We had some early reports of people having memory lapses and some cardiovascular problems. There were a couple of strokes, etc. Well, that list that I put on my slide when I'm talking has increased dramatically. We know that the virus doesn't just attach onto respiratory tissues. It attaches onto endothelial cells. And so this is how it gets into the bloodstream, as many people believe. So it can disseminate throughout the body. People that have recovered, there are reports the lungs have been so adversely affected with the pathology, maybe a hyperimmune response, that people who used to scuba dive, people who used to run marathons and stuff like this, they just don't have the lung capacity. We've looked at rashes. We've looked at all sorts of mental deficiencies with this. So it's a far-reaching secondary ramification rather than just saying, hey, I had COVID-19, I got over it, I'm okay. And this is not just older people, by the way. These are reports that they're also in younger people, you know, the 18 to 40-year-olds that originally people said, well, they can't get it, which didn't make any sense at all. So we continue to learn the histopathology of what the ramifications of the infection are like. That has helped, believe it or not, because it's given the hospitals, the medical workers, the heroes there, so much more information where now we're more people alive. True, they may be in a hospital for extended periods of time, but thank God the deaths or the death rate has gone down a bit, which is good. We still have a highly infectious virus, and we have to stop that spread. And we have not done nearly as well as many parts of the rest of the world. And that's what concerns a lot of us who look at this, or certainly the people who are working in this, and that we have not brought that high level down. You can look at the map and you can see that, yeah, we're in the last couple of weeks, the number of cases has decreased a bit, which is fine, but we're also entering into the fall, which is flu season, another respiratory infection.
Yeah.
And
so can you talk about that? So everybody in my family has a flu shot except for me, you know, and I got to get it soon, but like, coach us through the flu season. What do you know about flu season coming up, and what would you say to a bunch of dental professionals watching? Well,
if there's any good news here right now, and this, hopefully there'll be more, one of the things that is seen, obviously flu is a respiratory infection, different virus, not nearly as severe typically as COVID-19. The death rate is far, 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 far lower, like about a tenth of a percent versus over 3% for COVID. But this year, one of the things that's been noticed is in the Southern Hemisphere, Australia, South Africa, places like this, their flu season has been very, very mild compared to previous flu seasons. And that's good. They've had almost record low numbers of cases. And one of the postulated reasons is because of the concern and response in those countries to COVID-19. People have been wearing masks. They've been washing their hands. They've been social distancing. They're doing the right things. And so what that does is that has limited, to a certain extent, passage of influenza viruses from person to person, because that's a droplet-mediated virus. And so looking at it in that way, here in the United States, if we can do the same things that have been recommended for so long now, that may make the flu season milder, which could certainly affect the incidence of SARS-CoV-2 infection in the population. The trick is, sorry to say it, people have to do it. And you know as well as I, Kirk, you see people out there who say, well, it's my constitutional right not to wear masks, not to do this. We see this all the time. And I don't even know what to say to something like that, because we know what's working, and we're seeing this in other countries. Now, we just have to do that here. So the good news, hopefully, is that the flu season, if we do the right things that we were supposed to be doing all along for COVID, may help us with the flu season being less severe than it could be. And that could help with regard to passage of other respiratory infections, including SARS-CoV-2.
Yeah. Well, I think we've kind of gotten all our brains around that. Like, this isn't going away as fast as we had hoped. And I'm on the optimism side. Like, I want the world to get better, but we're going to have to prepare. If you're a young dentist watching right now, like, you got to get your brain around this. This is going to be, we're going to have implications of this for a while. But in the midst of that, like, the word vaccine comes up a lot. Give us an update on, and let me just say this, there's no promise for a vaccine, is there?
No. There is some excellent work. There's some excellent progress. As you know, and as your viewers know, there are a number of vaccines that have been in clinical trials. A couple of them are in phase 3 clinical trials, and that's good. because they've had to pass some very rigorous testing, but there still is a ways to go. And again, this is something where you have to look at the science, you have to look at the results of science, and you have to look at the standards that vaccines have to go by. Safety first. The last thing you want to do is put a vaccine out that is going to cause an unreasonable amount of side effects, short term and long term. And we have unfortunate history with that, which I'll get into in a minute. You also have to look at efficacy, and not just efficacy, meaning that you produce antibodies, but efficacy in that, are these antibodies protective? And then how long are they protective? Part of the problem with coronaviruses in general, the earlier, general respiratory infections caused by coronaviruses, rhinoviruses, is that you make antibodies, but they only last for a short period of time. So for a vaccine to be useful in a large scale, you need a vaccine that's going to lead to long-term protection. And quite frankly, we have thousands of top-notch qualified scientists and technicians around the world working on this. They have been tireless in their efforts to come up with something that is not only going to induce an immune response, but a protective immune response. But that takes time. That takes time. So the fact that something is in three trials isn't all. You have to look at all evaluations. You had one vaccine that was a trial that was stopped for a couple of days, and then it started again this past week because they had some adverse effects that they had to investigate. You need to look at that. And these may not be common reactions like injection site soreness or low-grade fever for a couple of days from the inflammation. Those are common things that we see. Mm-hmm. We're looking at things that could be neurological. You're looking at some long-term systemic effects that you didn't anticipate, that don't come out in one every 100 people, maybe come out in one every couple of 100,000 people. Because when you're vaccinating large populations, even a small serious adverse effect can affect literally tens and hundreds of thousands of individuals. And that's not good.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example. And I apologize to your viewers for taking some time with this. And I was recently talking with some of my colleagues, and because I'm older than them, I remember this stuff. 1976. I don't know if you remember, Kurt, but we were obviously concerned about flu outbreaks. We had a bad flu pandemic in, I think, 1958. We had another one in 67 or 68, which killed 1 million people worldwide. And so we were looking for these periodic flu pandemics, which, we had to take care of and be careful of. Well, it turned out, I believe it was 1976, in Fort Dix in New Jersey, suddenly there was an outbreak of influenza among some of the people in there. I want to say 12 to 15 or 18 individuals, and a couple of them died. And it was a flu. It was influenza. And the fear was that because flu doesn't usually kill like this, certainly younger people, that we were entering into a new flu pandemic called the swine flu, if you recall. Mm-hmm. And Gerald Ford was the president at the time. And what happened is because they had this early warning, they moved into rapid mode to develop a vaccine for this strain of influenza. And the country was in a panic. It was thinking, pandemic, we have to do this. They rushed this vaccine through within a couple of months. And they were giving it to people as rapidly as they could. I forget how many 100,000 cases, how many 100,000 vaccinations there were. I was in Pittsburgh at the time. And people were just running to get this because they had heard the hype about this coming pandemic. It turned out that there were more adverse effects than they had anticipated. Things like Guillain-Barré, which you may have heard of, which is a rare neurological disorder of say, demyelination of the neurons, paralysis in the extremities. Can lead to death, but usually leads to residual paralysis. And we're seeing a number of cases of this. And that happens rarely with influenza vaccine, but not nearly to the extent they saw it. On top of it, people were so afraid, for example, older people, people with conditions, heart conditions, that they saw an incidence of people getting strokes after this and heart attacks or whatever it is. And it turned out that the virus continued to drift to a seasonal form. So the pandemic never came. And that, to me, was the beginning of the anti-vaccine stuff that we see today. Because people said, wait a minute, you were telling me this is so important, I had to do this, this was rushed through, and it never came. You gave us a vaccine where some people died, some people had this severe reaction, more so than if the thing had been tested over extended periods of time. And that, to me, in 1976, was a real example of what can happen when you rush something through. Not that that's going to happen here, but there are lessons to be learned from that.
Right.
And so you rush this through. You can't just say, "Oh, we're pretty close with the phase 3 clinical trial termination. We have enough data." You don't have enough data, because even after that, you still have to look to see how it is in different populations down the road. Older people, people with diabetes, people who are obese, people who have other conditions. We don't know. Different age groups. And that's something that is a real concern. And this thing I mentioned here, and I won't take any more of your time, is if this vaccine is not done right, if it's not done right and well and meets all the highest standards, period, just the highest standards, forget government approval, the highest standards that they've all supposed to have met, that could mess up other vaccines. But people are going to continue to lose confidence in vaccines, and then other vaccines, measles, mumps, HPV, things like this, chickenpox, parents won't have their kids get it. Because they're going to say vaccines are dangerous. And we already know that, you know, like last year, look what happened with measles, where we had the outbreak with measles. So you have to do all the steps. This is incredibly rapid, what they're doing with the vaccine here, incredibly rapid. And I don't think that the end of phase 3 trials is going to be, or should be, yeah, this is good, we're going to get it. Even if they approve it rapidly, whenever that is, it's going to take quite a while to vaccine out. They could say whatever they want. You and I are not going to be getting it right away, Kirk. It's going to be quite a while before we get it.
Right. A couple of questions I have, because I get these questions, like stage 3 or phase 3, this is the hardest one, and this is where a lot of them get kicked out. Can you just add, because some of us are getting our news from, you know, TV and social media, so that's not – like, I want to ask you, what is stage 3 or phase 3 of the testing process?
Well, in the clinical trials, you have phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3. And they all look for, obviously, safety. You have smaller groups of people in phase 1 and phase 2. Phase 3 has tens of thousands of individuals. The idea is, after you pass phase 1 and phase 2 for safety, efficacy, number of doses, to produce high levels of antibodies, you have to expand the test group to as many different types of individuals as possible. That's probably a bad phrase to use. But the thing is, you want to look for more uncommon adverse reactions. Again, this is a way of testing safety. And you may see something that only occurs in maybe 1 in 100,000 doses, 1 in whatever it is. But by increasing the size of the clinical trial group, you have a better chance of seeing that. Like, for example, the two people in this clinical trial that had this reaction that they had to stop, and then they looked to investigate and deemed that whatever it was going to allow the vaccine trial to continue. You need to do that. Even with that, with tens of thousands of individuals, you're still not in the clear, because when you're vaccinating a population, you're vaccinating millions of people. And so if something happens one in a million, multiply that by how many hundreds of millions of people are going to be vaccinated, or billions of people worldwide, and you can see where the number of that one type of severe adverse reaction could grow very, very rapidly. And that's what you need to protect against. It's not perfect. Nobody is going to say that all vaccines are perfect. There are side effects, but you try to prevent as much as you possibly can by doing the quality control, the testing, those rare adverse effects that you can't predict with your clinical trial group. And it just takes scientific rigor to do this.
Yeah. Now, another question that I get, I don't know the answers, but can you speak to the word mutation? There's always the possibility there's going to be mutations or a mutation. How does that play into this?
That's true. And these respiratory viruses, not just coronaviruses, influenza viruses, of course, drift from season to season. That's why we need a new flu vaccine every year. The question I know is on people's minds working in this. And they're actually tracking. I wish I understood it, but I don't. They're actually tracking the mutations of SARS-CoV-2, SARS-CoV-1, some of these other coronaviruses, to see if the mutation, for example, with the S protein, which is the major antigen that is being looked at as far as a vaccine antigen, if there are going to be some mutations, virus that could affect that, where now the vaccine doesn't take care of the current strain. You know what I mean? That now we have a new strain out there. I haven't heard much about this lately, so I apologize for my ignorance, but I haven't heard much about the fact that the virus has been mutating to where that is possible at this point. That's good news. Mm-hmm. In fact, that holds true, but they have to look at and continue to look at that.
Right. Right. Well, the thing that we're always trying to do here is just prepare dentists for a bright future. You know, while all this is going on, we've watched the trends. Like, people are like, oh, this is going to go away. And we were quick to do it. But if I'm a young dentist watching right now, and you're the infection control expert in dentistry, give me some perspective. I'm a 32-year-old dentist. What do I need to be thinking about in the future? And then the word aerosol comes up a lot. Like, help me understand where we're at, what the future might look like, best on what we know today.
That's a good question. I'm glad you asked that, because I was hoping to bring this in. One of the things that, well, I'm proud of dentistry. I'm not a dentist, proud of you all. I think dentistry has responded. I think dentists, hygienist assistant, were so scared, as everybody else was, that when some of these interim recommendations came out about universal source control, you know, wearing a mask all day in practice, aerosol generating procedures where you need N95 respirators or some of these other respirators, dentistry has responded. I have talked to many, many, many colleagues over the last months, and I'm proud of them. They've done what they're, I mean, something so different. Wearing masks was a problem for some guys and ladies. And now they're not only wearing masks, but they're looking at N95s. Some of them have some of these other respirators, which are much more reusable and cleanable, et cetera. I think has responded very positively. The comments that I'm getting back, many people, is the patients see that, and the patients appreciate the efforts. I think in the beginning, the patients were very hesitant because everybody was in a panic, you know, and unfortunately we had all different opinions out there that, you know, that just didn't make sense. But you all responded. And I think that's great, because what I'm hearing is, you know what, my patients come in, they know what to expect. They see that I have this air recirculation unit in here, or that I've redone our HVAC system to improve this. We talk about this. They ask questions. I have answers. They're not afraid of my N95 mask. I'm trying to do the best I can, and they appreciate that. And so I think that dentistry has responded. I think we need more information. And one of the things that I would like to see, is early on, but if there was a way to have done a serologic test on dental professionals before the shutdown or soon after the shutdown, but in the early stages, like they were doing with hospital workers, to see what the infection rate was in dental professionals before you were using N95 respirators and the air filtration units. And now looking at dentists, hygienist assistants, whatever group you want to test, but certainly dentists, to look to see what percentage of dentists, for example, have antibodies, meaning that they were infected and could have been asymptomatic, but that would also give us an indication of the infection rate, the occupational infection rate, compared to the general population. Now, because a dentist or hygienist or assistant has antibodies and may have had the infection, doesn't mean that they got it in the office. Those are other kinds of things. But you see, that kind of basic data, like we used to have for hepatitis B, for HIV, gave us information on occupational risks. And so there's still work to do, but no, I think dentistry has responded. I think you guys and ladies have done the job. Just continue doing it. Don't get complacent because caseloads are going down. Don't get complacent because that's the worst thing we can do.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is an incredibly noble profession, and it was so cool to watch so many people come together and respond positively. This profession is incredibly resilient with great people. I know you've watched a lot of practices. We have two practices we coach go back and have some of their biggest months ever, and they're always thinking about how it can be ahead. And I think it's critically important. Education brought us together. Our commitment is just to bring real good science and information from the thought leaders in all of dentistry consistently on a regular basis so that, you know, you can go back and have a good peace of mind just whether you're talking with your team. Give us some advice. So this is another challenge. And again, I don't know who to ask this to, but you're, you know, you being the man, like if I'm a young dentist and I've got a team of 10, you know, they go home and they get information from, you know, the news or Facebook or YouTube, and they might be panicking a little bit. What would you say to a dentist who's like, I got to deal with all these people bombarding me with, oh, I heard this, I saw that, you know, type of thing. Anything you would say that would help us along the journey ahead that we're looking at for the next couple months?
Well, you have to talk to people. You have to talk to each other. Even before this started, I was always talking about practice meetings, lunchtime meetings. You know, if you're introducing a new type of glove or you're looking at some new type of dental waterline treatment and things like that, talk amongst each other. So that not only are the assistants and the hygienists on the same page with the dentist, but they may have some suggestions about how to implement this thing or if it's feasible or not. Same thing with this pandemic. Talk to people. Make sure that people are conscientious with what they're doing, that even after they leave the practice, they're doing the right things. Wearing face masks. Okay, social distancing. Hand hygiene has increased dramatically, which is great. That's the basic. Think about it. I mean, that goes back to the early hundreds. And now everybody's doing it and talking about it. Look to see where we have good information. The ADA provides good information. The CDC continues to provide good information. I know the CDC has taken some hits recently, and that's really unfortunate, really unfortunate, because people like me have relied on the CDC forever, good information. And I hate to see some of this political crap that affects people's trust in these things. Look to the people who are the leaders. I don't want to use the word experts, but look to the people who are the leaders with the information coming out. That information is readily available. You might have to sort through some of the nonsense that's out there with it, but that helps keep the dentist, it keeps the staff on the same page, and I hope makes them feel more comfortable with what they're doing. As an example, and Kurt, you probably saw this too. When people first heard that they would have to wear N95 respirators for aerosol-generating procedures, people went, what are you, crazy? Right. I can't breathe with that stuff. I mean, I had people who used to say, I can't breathe with a regular mask. Mm-hmm. And you did it, didn't you?
Yeah.
Just like when people started wearing gloves.
I remember that conversation.
Where people weren't wearing gloves. And when we told them to wear gloves, I had people, I won't say who or where, but I had people who cut the fingers off the gloves and then put them on. And they said, okay. And I went, wait a minute. It doesn't work like that. You have to keep up, but you have to do it rationally.
Yeah.
And you can't get crazy about these things.
Yeah. Now we're going to have you back over and over again. And I have like a million more questions. And I know like we're so lucky to get you because I know you're getting ready to go on vacation here. But like I just what you know about PPE, Ian, because we went to the crazy side of things and then we came back to a rational side. But what's the state of PPE right now? Just like as we look at the future, what do you know?
The N95 short supply still, which is crazy. I mean, look at 9 months. One of the things that I've seen, but other people smarter than me are seeing, is that there are other types of respirators that are reusable. Hold on, I have something here. Let me just look one second because I get all messed up with this. Come on, stop it, John. Where is it? It's this elastomer. High efficiency respirator. It's made of silicone and plastic. It's like a half face shield. It almost looks like Darth Vader. Okay. But they have filters that you can replace. And because of the nature of this material, it's cleanable. It can be disinfected versus an N95 that's soiled. You can use it. And I know of at least one dental school, possibly more, that have gone to this. And what they've done is they've issued this to students, faculty, and staff, and this is theirs. And they've saved thousands of dollars on N95 respirators, because these things are reusable. So what's happening is as we're getting more used to this type of high efficiency respiration, you have to do now in the practices, you're finding that there are other things that have been out there. Like these elastomer respirators that were not used in medicine or dentistry. They were used in industry. And now they're finding applications in healthcare. And so that's some of the stuff that is continuing to evolve. You know, now we've gotten over the shock of having to wear some of this stuff. And now we're looking at how can we do this more efficiently? Are there other things out there that we can adapt to? And that's where some of the things are coming out.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, like I said, we're going to have you back over and over. Give us a good word for the future between now and when we see you next. Like, cause we got a lot of young dentists watching. We got a lot of students watching and we got a lot of dentists that are established practitioners. What would you give us a good word for the day?
Stay positive. Your dental care is essential care. Your patients rely on you to provide quality care and safe care. My area, of course, is not dentistry, but I'm infection control is one of my areas. And so what we try to do is maintain the highest standards for this. Look at the things that have a scientific basis, a proven clinical basis. You are highly educated. You are highly trained to provide excellent care. Look at continuing to do that, providing safe care, both for your patients, but also to protect you. Remember, you are the major target of occupational exposure. And so what you're doing is protecting you first. You're also protecting your patients.
Yeah. And I think it's awesome, John. Also protect your team and just great, great stuff. So, buddy, I am so grateful. I know you're a super busy guy in your midst of going on vacation. It's been great. Now, if you guys are watching and many of you have asked, like, when are we putting the band back together? We are officially putting the band back together. Now, you're going camping. We might even like get you in while you're sitting there. You should enjoy yourself. But I want to let everybody know we're going to have the COVID reunion starting next week, next Friday at ACT Dental U, September 25th. So don't miss it. So mark your calendars. You guys will get an invite. And we've got a lot of the greats coming back, a lot of the great experts, opinion leaders, instructors, educators. We've been sending out emails. You guys have been so great to say, I'm in, I'm in, I'm in. So we just needed to take a break ourselves, you know, for 15 weeks. We did a lot of education. Then, we need to get back to taking care of ourselves, our clients, and our families. And now we're back and stronger than ever with a great group of great people. And that includes you, John. I can't thank you enough how grateful I am for you just showing up and providing great leadership for our community and great education. And buddy, we're going to keep having you back over and over and over again. Sound good?
Thanks, Kurt. I appreciate it. Hope it was useful.
It's always been useful. So there you have it for the Best Practices Show this week. Again, mark your calendars. Do us a favor. Share this episode if you found this valuable, which I hope you did. And we'll be back next week with a whole bunch of new Best Practices shows. You guys take care of yourselves. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Kurt.
Thanks, Jeff.